This is Julian Morrow with you on Sunday Extra, and now we're going to talk about what our next guest describes as a misunderstood virtue that has an elusive quality and yet is one of the essential fluids in our social machine. Krista Lawler is Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University, and her new book is called Being Reasonable, The Case for a Misunderstood Virtue. Professor Lawler, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Julian. Delighted to be here.
Krista, why and how is reasonableness misunderstood?
Oh my gosh. When I first started getting interested in this topic, I would talk to people and some people thought, oh, you know, that's just a word people in power use in order to convince the others that they're right. Or, oh, there's no saying what's reasonable. It's entirely subjective. Or even worse, and a philosopher will distinguish this from being subjective, even worse, there's just no fact of the matter about, you know, what's reasonable or what it means. And I just was puzzled by this because it seemed obvious to me that there were, at least pretty obvious, there were many unreasonable things that I could identify that other people agreed with me were unreasonable. So it was really puzzling why it's so hard to say in so many words what it means.
Yeah, and I suppose that's that elusiveness that you refer to. Is it possible to define what reasonableness is clearly?
Yes, well, that's exactly, you know, what I set myself to do in this book. I mean, define, right? It's not like I have a proper philosophical analysis, so I can say, you know, these are the necessary and sufficient conditions. But in the way that we can say something quick about what it takes to be generous, right? In that same way, I think we should be able to say something pretty quick and meaningful about what it means to be reasonable. And so that's what I set myself. Yeah, so the definition I hit on is that a reasonable person is really concerned to get it right about value, about the things that matter, and to promote value where they see it. Generally, if you're reasonable, you're pretty reliable about tracking things that matter, right? That's another way of putting it, and knowing what matters and acting on that knowledge. It's kind of abstract in a way, but it really is, I've come to think, the core of the matter.
And we'll come back to that idea of value, Krista, but I also wanted to explore something that you spend a bit of time on in the book, which is the distinction between being reasonable and being rational. Could you please give us a rational and reasonable explanation of the distinction?
This distinction, I think it can get kind of fuzzy depending on how you think of rationality. So some people think of rationality in this very broad way, and then the distinction is harder to actually identify. But if you think about rationality the way, say, an economist thinks about it, you know, you're sort of maximizing self-interest, or you're acting in this entirely prudent way regarding your own self-interest, then the distinction between reasonable and rational is very clear, because a reasonable person actually sees and understands value from other people's points of view as well, and will be moved by what they understand, you know, about value as it appears to other people. You know, an example of this is, say, I'm stuck in traffic. It would be really good for me if I used the breakdown lane and jumped in ahead of everybody. Doing that, of course, though, you know, maybe there's an emergency vehicle that might need that lane or something. And from a self-interested point of view, there may be an obvious thing for me to do, but it isn't a reasonable thing to do.
Yes. And one of the ways you demonstrate this is recounting what's known as the dictator game. Could you explain that for us, please?
Yes, the dictator game is a very simple game that economists talk about. So a dictator, say I'm the dictator, you're the recipient. I'm given a certain sum of money, say $10, and I get to decide how much to keep and how much to give you. And if people are told, okay, the dictator is reasonable, what do you think the dictator is going to do? Subjects in these studies will say, oh, well, the dictator will give, you know, something close to half of it away. Maybe not exactly half. Maybe they'll keep $6 and give away $4. If subjects are told, okay, the dictator is rational, what will the dictator do? Then the people in the study, the subjects will say, oh, the dictator will, you know, of course, if they're rational, they'll just keep most of it. Right. So we're using these terms to govern our expectations about how people will behave. Will they behave in a more self-interested way, or will they do something that's a little more looks okay from other people's point of view?
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Krista Lawler, Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University, about her new book, Being Reasonable: The Case for a Misunderstood Virtue. And it's funny you use that phrase, the case, Krista, because the reasonable person and reasonableness are a often used concept in the field of law. That's something that you explore in the book. What are your observations about how the concept of reasonableness and the reasonable person are used in law?
You know, it's fascinating to me because when I first started this project, I was thinking, well, it's so important in the law. Of course, philosophers of law and jurisprudence, they'll have a story about what it means to be reasonable. I'll just go read up on that. I'll learn about what they think. And what I found was just so much disagreement. And as there seemed to be a ton of agreement that it's a very important thing to be able to appeal to this standard, the reasonable person standard, it does so much good work for us and is very hard to replace with any other standard. That was fascinating. That was the first thing that was fascinating. Wow, Anglo-American law is saturated with this standard. It gets used more and more over time. You see, after its introduction, way back when Oliver Wendell Holmes started talking about reasonable doubt. And then it just crept into every area of law, administrative law, sexual harassment cases. Tort law was a big first use of it. You know, when you're trying to adjudicate, has somebody damaged another person's well-being in a way that they really need to be held accountable? And the thought was, well, if some reasonable foresight would have prevented you from harming this person in some way, then, and you didn't exercise reasonable foresight, then now you're responsible for making them whole. And so it's fascinating how important it is and how much disagreement there is about what it means.
Yeah, what are some of the cases that most stood out to you as revealing some of the complexities of the concept of reasonableness?
One of the first cases that law students learn is the case of Menlove, who built this hayrick or haystack next to some cottages that were being rented out, and the hayrick caught fire. He had been warned repeatedly that the way he'd built it wasn't safe. And, he tried to put a chimney through it to make it more safe, which only made it less safe. He claimed that he had exercised as much caution as he was capable of, being a man of not too great intellect. And the court promptly shot that down and said, look, you're held to this standard that's more objective than that. It's not just doing your best by your lights. You have to rise to this more public standard. And that's a fascinating case, I think. It's one every law student learns. I think it's a little problematic because Menlove was arguably making lots of different kinds of mistakes. So I think there are more interesting cases where highly competent people are held to be unreasonable. So I talk about this one case in the book, this guy, Rudy Stanko, who is driving through Montana at about 85 miles an hour. I guess that's 100, almost 140 kilometers per hour on a narrow lane, essentially. And he thought he was doing a great job as a driver, And the policeman pointed out that if somebody was crossing the road or ahead of him, he hadn't got time to stop and so forth. And the fascinating thing is he said, well, I don't understand really what it means to be reasonable. What is this standard you're trying to hold me to? I thought that was great. It seems like, for many people, it's a reasonable question. When I talk to my students about this case, they say, well, I think he was right. I think there should be a strict limit that the Montana, traffic law should have stated 60 miles an hour. You go more than that, then you're going too fast. It should be explicit. And that's, I think, a very natural impulse to have. Like, if the law is going to hold, judge our behavior, it should state explicit limits. But the reasonable person standard does this interesting work of letting the law take this flexible form, right?
We crave specifics and clarity, and the concept of reasonableness really doesn't give us that. But you also write, Krista, that the law needs to remain silent about what reasonable means. Why do you say that?
This is a point I learned from John Gardner's work. John Gardner, no longer with us, but he was a wonderful jurisprude. And he made a very strong case that if the law gives more guidance to us and says explicitly, okay, here's what kind of behavior we expect here, then that becomes settled law. And that's all the law can ask of you then. So a nice illustration of this is, say the law tells us in no uncertain terms, it gives us a list of the kinds of behavior that would count as cruel and unusual punishment or something. It just lists, these are the behaviors that are cruel and unusual. Then suppose somebody invents a new torture. Oh, it's not on the list. Right? So the law's committed itself to this explicit statement of these are the behaviors that we're going to count as cruel and unusual. Now the law can't be flexible enough to actually cover this case that we all think is a case that needs to be forbidden. So the law is needing to remain silent. It's partly because you want that flexibility.
Krista, how important is the ability to see a situation or an issue from the perspective of another person to being reasonable?
It can be very important because other people have a perspective on value that may show something to us that we hadn't taken account of at all. So one of the examples I just came across was, I want to be healthy. Maybe I start using a Fitbit. Maybe I start, you know, walking a certain number of steps every day. I think I've got health under control. And someone else points out to me, well, Krista, are you becoming kind of slavishly devoted to this Fitbit? That's not good for your psychological health. And I think, oh, I didn't think about that at all, you know. So another person there sees something about this thing we all value, health. Right? They see a facet of it that I hadn't been thinking about. So if I'm open to, you know, listening to this other person, I'm learning about something that matters, my health, thinking about it in a new way. That can be incredibly valuable. So I think we often hear about, oh, you have to see things from another person's point of view. It can sound like a burden. I think it can also be a wonderful teacher about the things that matter to you already.
Krista Lawler, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Julian.
Krista Lawler is Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University, and her book is Being Reasonable, The Case for a Misunderstood Virtue.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.